Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling one of the most critical events in the creation of the Book of Mormon, the loss of the first 116 pages.
It's a foundational crisis, really.
Yeah.
And our mission today is to look at the textual fingerprints it left behind. We're going to be forensic analysts.
Exactly. We're focusing on this key theory called the Mosiah priority.
Right. The idea that the beginning of the book, as we know it today, was actually the very last part to be written down.
And you'll see the evidence for this is pretty compelling. We're going to hit three main areas. First, why this whole crisis made Joseph Smith and even God seem suddenly powerless.
Then we'll get into the actual textual problems, the inconsistencies in prophecy that pop up all over the place.
And finally, why the whole idea of the small plates looks a lot like a narrative patch, something invented after the fact to solve a huge problem.
Okay, so let's set the stage. The drama here is intense. Martin Harris is the scribe, and he's under immense pressure from his wife, Lucy, who is deeply skeptical.
Right. She thinks it's all a fraud.
So Martin begs Joseph to let him take the 116 pages he's transcribed to show her. Joseph says he asked God twice, got a no, but on the third try,
he gets a yes. And of course, the manuscript vanishes. We still don't know for sure if it was lost or intentionally destroyed.
And Joseph's reaction is what's really telling. He doesn't say, no problem, I'll just do it again. He panics. His mother quotes him as saying, oh my God, all is lost. All is lost. I have sinned.
And everything just stops. The whole project goes on hold for 9 months.
That reaction, that pure panic, is your first big clue. If the translation was tight, you know, if he was just reading words off the stone, like a teleprompter retranslating would be easy.
It would be the ultimate proof. He could have just dictated the exact same text again and called their bluff.
Exactly. Any forgery Lucy Harris produced would have been immediately exposed. His fear suggests the process was more creative, more of an oral dictation that he knew he couldn't possibly replicate word for word.
He was afraid of being caught in a contradiction.
He was terrified of it. And this leads to this really strange inconsistency in power. Joseph says God was so angry that he physically took the golden plates and the interpreters away from him.
Which is a massive supernatural act. God can just teleport heavy metal plates at will.
Right, but then you have the seer stone. This is the very tool Joseph had used for treasure digging, the tool he claimed could find any lost object.
And it suddenly can't find a 116-page stack of paper.
It's completely useless. The divine power to locate things just vanishes the second Joseph loses physical control of the evidence. It's convenient.
So after this 9-month pause, he gets a new revelation. This is what's now Doctrine and Covenants, Section 10, and it explicitly forbids him from retranslating those pages.
And the reason given is, frankly, a bit convoluted. It claims that Satan has inspired wicked men, presumably aligned with Lucy Harris, to alter the original manuscript.
The idea being that if Joseph produced a new translation, they would reveal the altered original and say, see, he can't even get his own story straight.
But if you think about that for a second, it makes no sense. An all-powerful God is worried about a 19th century forgery. If Joseph had reproduced the text perfectly, any other version with different handwriting, different ink, on different paper would be instantly revealed as a fraud.
It would have proven he was a prophet.
It would have been undeniable proof. Instead, God seems to choose the one path that creates the most long-term doubt and suspicion.
So this is where the Mosiah priority comes into play. Since he can't go back to the beginning, he just picks up where he and Martin Harris left off.
That's it. He starts dictating the Book of Mosiah and continues all the way to the end through the Book of Moroni. Only after all of that is done does he go back to write a replacement for the beginning, First Nephi through Words of Mormon.
And this out-of-order process leaves, as you said, fingerprints all over the text.
Clear as day. Scholars like Brent Metcalf have done fascinating work on this. You can track stylistic changes in the writing. For example, look at the use of the word wherefore versus therefore.
They mean the same thing, basically.
Pretty much. But as Joseph gets deeper into the dictation, toward the end of the original sequence books like Ether and Moroni, his use of wherefore starts to spike. It becomes a go-to transition word.
Almost like a verbal tic that develops over time.
You could call it that. And what's incredible is that this high frequency of wherefore then carries over directly into First Nephi, the replacement text that was written last. The style of the end of the project bleeds into the replacement beginning.
That's a subtle but really powerful piece of evidence for a single author working sequentially.
But it gets even more obvious when you look at the content, specifically at prophecy. This is probably the biggest giveaway.
Okay, lay it out for us.
When you read the book in its final published order, the earliest prophets the ones in the replacement section, knew stunningly specific things about the future.
More than the later prophet.
Vastly more. Take Nephi. He's writing the replacement text around 600 BC. He states, flat out, that the Messiah will come in exactly 600 years from the time his father left Jerusalem. He even prophesies that the name of an apostle will be John.
Incredibly specific details.
Now, fast forward a few hundred years in the narrative to King Benjamin and Alma. These are prophets in the section that was written first. They supposedly have Nephi's record.
So they should know about the 600-year timeline.
You think. But they speak only in the vaguest terms. King Benjamin says the time is not far distant. Alma says, the time cometh. We know not how soon.
They seem to have forgotten the single most important prophecy they possessed.
It makes no sense. Unless you realize the 600-year detail was backfilled. It was written into Nephi's story after the vague prophecies of Alma and Benjamin were already set in stone.
You see the same pattern with Christ's visit to the Americas, don't you?
Absolutely. The prophets in the middle books, like Alma, seem completely unaware that this is going to happen. When they finally hear about it, their people react with great joy and gladness, as if it's brand new information.
But if you read 1 Nephi, written last, it's described in great detail, hundreds of years earlier.
It's a huge plot hole. And it was created by what some researchers call the black hole of specificity. Joseph's fear of the lost manuscript reappearing forced him to be deliberately vague in that whole replacement section.
He couldn't risk naming a specific king or a city if that name was in the lost pages, because he might get it wrong.
Exactly. He had to be generic. Look at the books of Jacob and Jerem, all in the replacement part. They cover about 238 years of history. In that entire time, only four new names are introduced. Kings aren't named. They're just called the second king or the third king.
It's a black hole of detail.
It is. But the second you exit that black hole and hit the Book of Mosiah, the point where the original dictation resumed, this specificity just explodes.
Right. Mosiah chapter 1, verse 1, what happens?
He immediately names King Benjamin's three sons, Mosiah, Helorim, and Helaman. Boom. Specific names right away. A level of detail that was completely absent for the previous 100 pages.
It's a jarring transition.
So jarring that even apologists like J.N. Washburn pointed it out. He noted that the very end of Omni, the book that bridges the replacement text into Mosiah, is just a weird jumble of names and unrelated story fragments.
Like an author trying to stitch two completely different pieces of fabric together.
That's a perfect analogy. He's struggling to bridge the intentional vagueness with the very specific narrative that he'd already dictated months earlier.
And what about the Liahona, the compass?
Another great example. Throughout the replacement text, Lehi's guide is just called the ball or the compass. The specific, unique name Liahona doesn't actually appear until the Book of Alma, which, again, was written before the replacement text was composed. He seems to have come up with a name later in the process and forgot to retroactively add it to the beginning.
Also, all this vagueness and the need for a new beginning leads to the final piece of the puzzle.
The small plates of Nephi.
He needed a new source document. He couldn't retranslate, so he needed a different set of plates to explain where the new text came from.
And here's the kicker. That revelation, DNC 10, actually told him to translate from the unabridged large plates of Nephi. That should have produced a text that was longer and more historically detailed than the 116 pages.
Which would have been a huge risk. He needed the replacement to be shorter and vaguer, not longer and more specific.
And so the concept of the small plates is born. It only appears in 1 Nephi, the replacement text. And conveniently, Nephi explains that these plates are meant for more spiritual things, not a detailed history.
The perfect excuse. It explains why the new beginning is shorter and less historically dense than the lost Book of Lehi was supposed to be.
It's a brilliant narrative fix. Nephi even gives a sort of coy hint, saying the plates were made for a wise purpose known only to the Lord. It's almost a wink to the reader, acknowledging the convenience of it all.
And of course, there's no mention of these small plates coexisting with the large plates anywhere in the section from Mosiah to Moroni, the part written first.
It's a concept that was invented out of necessity to solve the problem created by the lost pages.
So when you put it all together, the prophetic inconsistencies, the black hole of names that suddenly explodes with detail, the literary style bleeding from the end to the beginning, the invention of the small plates.
The conclusion becomes very hard to avoid. The first part of the book we read was the last part that was written.
What's so striking to me isn't just the literary gymnastics, but the nature of the divine solution offered here. God could have solved this problem cleanly.
Instantly. An angel could have retrieved the manuscript. The seer stone could have located it. God could have miraculously proven any forgery to be false. Any of those would have been undeniable proof.
But that's not what happened. Instead, the solution chosen is this complex, messy, literary cover-up that leaves behind a trail of inconsistencies that, frankly, create more doubt than faith.
And that's really the final thought to leave you with. The loss of the 116 pages wasn't just a crisis. It was a golden opportunity, a chance for Joseph Smith to provide testable, verifiable, undeniable proof of his divine calling.
But he didn't take it. Or, in his telling, God didn't take it.
Exactly. So you have to ask yourself, why would a divine being consistently choose the path that shores up the prophet's personal authority while actively avoiding any test that could be verified by outsiders? What does that tell you about the nature of the power being claimed?